today we are looking at what is happening in Eastern Europe. We wanted to do this, as I say, before we got to the summer when we break, because I think it is of great concern to all of us what is happening in Ukraine and in that region. The title which I've chosen for this is The Ukraine-Russia Crisis, Whatever Happened to Western Strategy? Because one of my own observations is that too many things are happening this day which take us by surprise, because we have not done a lot of strategic thinking on these issues, and perhaps our failure to respond in the ways that we should respond is because we haven't bothered to do that preparatory work. Our speakers are all experts in this. I'm going to introduce them from my right, and they're going to speak in this order. First of all, Robert Brinkley, who was the ambassador to Ukraine between 2002 to 2006, and he has a great deep knowledge of that country. After that, he was the High Commissioner in Pakistan, based in Islamabad, so he has a broad experience. Then Sir Gerald Howarth, my ex-colleague, former colleague from the House of Commons, who until recently was a minister in the Ministry of Defence. His title was the Minister for International Security Strategy, so what better person to talk to us today about strategy or the lack of it, and I look forward to hearing from him. And then the final speaker will be Sir Tony Brenton, who was formerly the British ambassador to Russia. He was there between 2004 and 2008, and many of you will have seen him appearing on television being interviewed about what is happening in the Ukraine part of the world. And we look forward to hearing from him too. So without any more ado, I should just mention there is a camera at the back of the room. Pakistan Television is going to make an edited edition of this particular debate, so don't worry, you're not being spied upon by anybody in particular. I'm going to now start by asking Robert Brinkley if he can speak to us for about 10 minutes, and when each has spoken, we'll then open it to questions and comments. Robert Brinkley.
Well, thank you very much, Lord Lothian. And I should say at the outset that these days I speak only for myself, not for any institution or anybody else. The question that you've set us, the Ukraine-Russia crisis, whatever happened to Western strategy? Russia's actions in annexing Crimea and now destabilizing parts of eastern Ukraine pose very clear threats to our interests. They violate the UN Charter, on which international peace and security have been based since 1945. They're counter to the Helsinki Final Act, which laid down that borders in Europe could be changed only by agreement. They fly in the face of the 1994 Budapest Memorandum, in which Russia, the US, and the UK undertook to uphold Ukraine's independent sovereignty and territorial integrity when Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. And they aim to deny the people of Ukraine the right to choose their own future. International law, peace in Europe, nuclear non-proliferation, and democracy are evident UK and Western interests. In response, what should Western strategy be, and has it fallen short? The first plank has been support for Ukraine, both political and financial. The International Monetary Fund has agreed a program of $18 billion over 2 years on conditions of fiscal discipline, a floating exchange rate, and reform, much needed, of the gas market. There will also be additional financial and technical assistance from the United States and the European Union. And the political part of the association agreement with the European Union has been signed. The economic part will come into effect later this month. Secondly, in respect of Russia, no Western government has suggested that we should respond militarily to Russia's actions. That's right and sensible. Having ruled out military action, the West, through the G7 and the European Union, has sought to influence Russian behaviour through political and economic sanctions. And of course, like all sanctions, in order to be effective, these have to be sustained and they have to be coordinated as widely as possible. Russia has been isolated politically. The G7 now meet without Russia after 17 years of meeting as G8. In the UN Security Council on the 15th of March, all members were in favour of a resolution declaring the Crimea referendum invalid, except for Russia, which vetoed, and China, which abstained. And by the way, China has not spoken in support of Russia's actions over Ukraine. The EU cancelled a summit with Russia and withdrew support for Russian accession to the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development and the International Energy Agency. The EU, US and Canada have imposed travel bans and asset freezes on some senior Russians and Ukrainians from the Yanukovych regime. The US has also imposed sanctions on companies associated with members of Putin's inner circle. But more significant than these sanctions in themselves has been the effect, the chilling effect, on international lenders and investors who have become much more reluctant to do business with Russia. And all this comes at a time when the Russian economy urgently needs investment. Growth stalled last year and was negative in the first quarter of this year. Fixed capital investment is low and falling, and there's been more capital flight from Russia so far in 2014 than in the whole of 2013. The EU has also been applying its competition and energy laws. Work on the South Stream gas pipeline has been suspended in Bulgaria and Serbia. Gazprom has been denied an exemption to have monopoly use of a pipeline for its Nord Stream gas across Germany to the Czech Republic. And the Commission is investigating possible breaches of competition law by Gazprom. Discussing the Ukraine crisis earlier this month, G7 leaders agreed that the status quo is unacceptable and the continuing destabilization of eastern Ukraine must stop. They insisted that Russia recognize the legitimate election of President Poroshenko, stop arms crossing the border into Ukraine, and cease support for separatist groups. They agreed that wide-ranging economic sanctions should remain on the table if Russia did not follow the path of de-escalation or if it launched a punitive trade war with Ukraine in response to Kiev proceeding with the trade aspects of its association agreement with the European Union. They also agreed to help Ukraine achieve greater energy security by diversifying its supplies. And the European Commission has been assisting in the negotiations between Ukraine and Russia over gas supplies. But unfortunately, Gazprom has just turned off the tap for the third time in 9 years. Now, of course, wide-ranging economic sanctions would be painful for some in Europe too, especially in German industry and French shipbuilders. And that's why there's been no rush to impose such sanctions. But I should say, as for the potential effect here on the City of London, it needs to be kept in proportion. Russia accounts for just 1.6% of UK exports, 1.7% of our imports, and just 0.5% of the overseas lending by British banks. The British Parliament has played an important part in stiffening UK strategy. In a debate in the House of Commons on Ukraine on the 18th of March, there was support from all sides for the toughest economic sanctions which could be agreed. And I should say that Sir Malcolm Rifkind, who was speaking here 2 days ago, was, I think, instrumental in achieving that result. NATO has agreed some limited measures to reassure allies in Central and Eastern Europe, troops to Poland, aircraft to the Baltics, and warships to the Black Sea. Overall, Putin's Ukraine adventure has boosted his popularity at home and distracted from the deteriorating Russian economy, but it could well end up damaging Russian interests. It has alarmed Russia's neighbours. Many of them are wondering who will be next. It has woken up the EU to the need to diversify energy supplies. It has given NATO a new sense of purpose, just as the Afghanistan mission is winding down. It's much too early to state that Western strategy has worked. Russia is still occupying Crimea and fomenting trouble in eastern Ukraine. Indeed, there is mounting evidence of Russian support for the separatists, including arms coming across the border into Ukraine. But I would argue that Western sanctions, coupled with the Ukrainian government's willingness to fight against armed separatists and infiltrators, have helped to restrain Russia. Putin pulled back from the threat of a conventional invasion of eastern Ukraine and has in practice recognized Poroshenko as Ukraine's legitimate elected president. So despite a slow start and inevitable differences of view, an agreed Western strategy has been developed, is being implemented, and contains the flexibility for more far-reaching steps. In order to safeguard our interests, we have to stay firm and united and be prepared to implement the threat of more serious sanctions if necessary. It will be a long haul.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Delighted to be here. I'm not quite sure what my qualifications are. I'm not an ambassador. I was in charge of defence diplomacy at the Ministry of Defence. I did have that very grand title of Minister for International Security Strategy, but I can assure you that others thought that they were in charge of that strategy rather than me. And it started with the Prime Minister and members of the Cabinet, and then the National Security Council, then the Secretary of State for Defence, and then me. So you can see I was pretty low down the pecking order, but it did give me a window in all the things that were going on in the world. My interest in Ukraine is that I'm not an expert, unlike two friends from the Foreign Office. My interest in Ukraine dates from about 2007 when I became director of a company called Landcom, which was farming in Ukraine, and we ended up with 200,000 acres of land which we were returning from being fallow too productive, and anybody who doesn't understand the concept of Ukraine being the breadbasket of the Soviet Union, stand on a hill and look at this fantastic sign of just acres and acres of land producing food. Very exciting. So that's my interest, but I'm going to approach this from a political point of view. I agree with very much of what is said by Robert, to you a moment ago. He has given you some of the facts of the situation. But I'm going to start by just saying that I actually think that we have not had a strategy as far as Russia is concerned since 1989. I think that has been our difficulty. I was always very conscious that we were prepared to enter into relations with China without demanding that they first become democratic. Today, China is very far from being democratic yet. We see the visit of the Prime Minister and so on, and the red carpet being rolled out. Russia was told that it had to become democratic before it would be kind of accepted into the Comity of Nations. And I think it's pretty hard because the Eastern European countries all had some experience of democracy before they were liberated in 1989. And I don't know about you, Michael, but I think it was one of the most exciting things as a politician. To be in Parliament and seeing the end of the Soviet Empire and peoples who've been subjected to tyranny and repression for the best part of half a century were being liberated, and that was the result of political action, and that was quite exciting. But Russia had never had any experience of democracy. The Tsars were not really democratic. So I think that we felt that, well, the Cold War had ended and we needed to move on to other issues. And I think since then, we've sometimes been cavalier about Russia. Occasionally, I think we've kind of poked Russia in the eye, and we did that over BMD, ballistic missile defense. Seemed to me to be a little bit unnecessarily provocative to seek to station ballistic missile defense, of which I am a very strong supporter, right on the borders of Russia, even though they were never intended to be a deterrent to Russia. They were clearly aimed elsewhere. Nevertheless, I felt that was not a particularly smart move. But manifestly, Russia has not been smart either. Indeed, I think Russia has been very unsmart. We've been talking about what has happened in Crimea, and that obviously is a key part of our debate today. But this is not the first act of naked aggression that has taken place by President Putin. He's already had a dry run elsewhere, in Georgia, where he marched into Abkhazia and South Ossetia. One of my parliamentary colleagues who went there soon after said that they'd come across an armoured personnel carrier which was stuffed full of Russian passports, which were to be issued to people in order to help the new Russian doctrine, which I will refer to in a moment. So we have past form here. So when this crisis blew up, I did ask William Hague on the floor of the House of Commons before the Russian annexation of the Crimea whether he had sought and secured from Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, an assurance that Russia would not resort to military intervention in Crimea. No such discussion had taken place, and within a few days, Russia had walked into the Crimea. I think that was a naked act of aggression. You've heard from Robert how it violated a whole range of treaties, but above all, it violated the Budapest Agreement, which you mentioned, the Budapest Agreement of 1994, which was signed by President Yeltsin, by Prime Minister John Major, and by President Clinton. And to remind you, in case you've forgotten, I'm sure this audience hasn't, but however I will remind you, that those countries reaffirm their commitment to Ukraine in accordance with the principles of the final act of the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe to respect the independence and sovereignty and the existing borders of Ukraine. It could not be clearer. And the deal was, you give up your substantial arsenal of nuclear weapons, Ukraine, and we will provide you with this assurance. It was not a guarantee that should anyone breach that, an invasion or support for Ukraine with military arms would follow. But it was quite clearly designed to reassure Ukraine that if they were to surrender their nuclear weapons, then they could expect that their borders would be respected. They haven't been respected. I have to say, the attitude of the Russian ambassador to London, I know there are officials from the Russian embassy here today, forgive me, it's not very clever to say, with the rights of national minorities violated and the interests of regions disregarded, the people of Crimea found it necessary to determine their own political future by means of a referendum. At least be honest, this was a writing what was perceived in Russia to be a wrong. I know, I work for the Sukhoi Design Bureau, some of you may know, designers, some very formidable, and as a pilot I can tell you, very exciting looking aeroplanes in the world. And I worked for a year for the Sukhoi Design Bureau. I understand how proud the Russian people feel, and I know how proud the Russian people have been to secure the recovery of the Crimea, which they felt should never have been given away by Khrushchev in 1954. However, they had there, and Sevastopol, I quite understand, is the spiritual home of the Russian Navy, just as Portsmouth is the spiritual home of the Royal Navy. But they had an agreement going through to 2042, extended from 2017. So there was no excuse for this. And I think Russia needs to understand that if the new doctrine is that you can intervene in another country. You can annex another country. You can annex their territory, in inverted commas, to protect the minority rights of those people. That is a very, very dangerous precedent. And what worries me is that the West's response has been utterly pusillanimous. Robert mentioned Sir Malcolm Rifkind, who, along with people like me, has been calling for the British government to take much tougher action. But we're always told that any further action could be an escalation. There is never any suggestion that Russia's actions are an escalation. We're seeing today not only that Russia is clearly exporting hardware into Ukraine, military hardware, but have also, according to the Secretary General of NATO, moved troops back across up to the Ukraine border. What is their intention? Well, I have a friend in Donetsk who was in the square when the riots were taking place, and on the BBC I was reading that, seeing that there were pro-Russian demonstrators and in the square. And as he said to me, those weren't pro-Russian Ukrainians, they were pro-Russian Russians. He said, I recognize the accents were all from St. Petersburg. And it is this naked action of Putin, and I'm sorry, it cannot continue. For where does it end? The chairman of the Defense Select Committee returned, I think yesterday, from the visit to the Baltic states, where he tells me there is a real sense of fear. Where does it end? How far is Putin going to push us? Is he going to annex the rest of eastern Ukraine? For in doing so, he would thereby secure a land link to the Crimea, which he does not currently have. He would also potentially take Odessa, which would then create a landlocked rump of Ukraine. He would then link up with Transnistria on the Moldovan border and basically surround Ukraine. Quite a lot of punishment for simply wanting to have a closer relationship with the EU. And so I do think that we have to think very carefully about how we approach Russia. We have a lot in common with Russia, not least our Christian heritage. And I think it is a tragedy that that Russia and the Western countries have come to this loggerhead over Ukraine. Quite understand they don't want a Cuba, as a gentleman over there suggested to me before we were speaking, that they don't want a Cuba on their doorstep. I quite understand that they are concerned. But there is no, unlike communism, our system of organized ourselves has never been for compulsory export. And so I think that unless Russia is challenged, then I don't know where this is going to end. And don't forget that Kaliningrad is an enclave all on its own on the Baltic Sea. I hope that that Russia will stop, that they will allow the new president of Ukraine to get on with trying to heal the wounds, bring the country together, stop trying to provoke trouble, make it absolutely clear there is no question of seeking a land link with the Crimea. And once that is done, then normal relations must be resumed and we have to get back on an even keel. But I'm afraid at the moment I don't see that that happening. And I do see that President Putin is exploiting the perceived, certainly the differences in the Western nations, many of whom are looking at their own national interest, which may in France's case be the export of Mistral ships, in the case of Germany, dependence on Russian gas, and $97 billion worth of inward direct investment into Russia from around the world, which itself, I suppose, could ultimately be at risk. But this is a very, very difficult time, and I hope that Russia will allow Ukraine to get on and flourish, and I'm sure they can have good relations with the EU and with the Russian Federation.
Gosh, I feel a bit like the man who walked into Tiffany's and asked for rhinestones, really. I'm going to present a slightly different picture. I'm happy to say that I agree with a lot of what Sir Gerald started off with, that we have rather neglected Russia, although On one key point he was wrong. It was, of course, Georgia that started the 2004 war, not Russia. What I want to do is, first of all, try and explain a little bit, and maybe I should explain myself first. I had a rough time as British ambassador in Russia. I am not paid by them. I have no personal interest in defending them. Nevertheless, if this sounds a bit odd, I think they are misunderstood. And I think it's important to understand where they are in order to understand how we deal with them going in. They're grumpy. Their view of the world is that the West has systematically neglected and humiliated them since the fall of communism. They have seen the expansion of NATO, contrary, they claim, to a promise they were given at the time. They have seen our war in Kosovo, and as they explain their breach of the Helsinki Final Act and the UN Charter, as Robert very clearly says they broke with regard to Crimea, they believe, not without some justification, that we did exactly the same with regard to Kosovo and with regard to Iraq. They saw the war in Georgia, which was started by the Georgians with a lot of American encouragement, and we all saw the result of that, but they feel that the West is out to get them. And as they looked at Ukraine, there is no country which they feel closer to in terms of social links, in terms of historical links, in terms of economic links. I make this comparison with a certain amount of caution, but it's a bit like the England-Scotland relationship. As they saw what they saw as a Western incursion into that country which was closest to them, you will remember Torya Nuland dishing out cookies to the rioters on the Maidan back then, and the assurances from Baroness Ashton, amongst others, that we were backing the Maidan protesters. They felt a direct stab at their own most direct national interests. They saw themselves as acting defensively. We can have an argument about whether they were right or wrong, but the seizure of Crimea in particular was very, very historically unique. Crimea ceased to be part of Russia in 1954, allegedly handed over by a drunken Khrushchev. It has always been, in the minds of most Russians, and I suspect in the minds of most Crimeans, part of Russia. And what they did was a sort of panic response to what they saw as the whole of Ukraine collapsing into Western arms. The point I'm trying to make here, in a rather long-winded way, is that what we are not looking at is the bear on the prowl again. We are looking at a no doubt bad, no doubt illegal, but unique set of circumstances with regard to Ukraine. We are not looking at a revanchist Russia about to move on to eastern Ukraine, which in fact they have very explicitly backed away from, Moldova, let alone Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, anywhere else. And that's an important fact to bear in mind, particularly as you read the Western press at the moment, because we have seen an extraordinarily lazy, stereotype-driven reaction. In actually not all the Western press, it's good in France, it's good in Germany, but here and in America, it's been balmy. As I say, the editors have seized the stereotype of the bear on the prowl again. That's what we read about. That is simply false. And Russian behaviour since Crimea has been to try and get the temperature down, to try and get things back under control, and to try and move things in Ukraine in the direction of what they really want. And they've been very explicit about what they really want. What they want is protection for the Russian-speaking minority in Ukraine, and Ukraine not to join NATO, along with the 11 previous ex-communist states, which have already done so. They see NATO as a direct threat. This country, as I say, closest to them. They're going to do an awful lot to prevent that. Okay, so that's where the Russians are. How do we handle it? It seems to me we have to have two clear objectives. The first is we have to worry about what's going to happen in Ukraine and look for the best possible outcome for the Ukrainian population. But secondly, and this has been quite widely forgotten, we need to think quite hard about what we're doing to Russia. Russia, well, I'll come on to this, but Russia, getting Russia to go in the right direction has to be a very big Western objective, if indeed it is possible. So, how do we proceed with those two objectives in mind? Well, there's some things which you obviously don't want to do. Don't demand the impossible. Crimea is a done deal. Whether we like to admit it or not, there is no way that Crimea is going to go back to Ukrainian sovereignty. Okay, we're not going to admit it for a while, but that's the reality. And secondly, Robert was talking eloquently about isolating Russia. That's balmy. You cannot isolate the second biggest economy in Europe, an economy which has just done a $400 billion gas deal with China. As Robert said, there was quite a big vote against Russia in the Security Council, but the key fact in that vote was the Chinese abstention. If you look at the behaviour of China, of India, of Brazil, of the big developing countries, they've all sat back and taken what's been known as the Miss Universe view of all of this, I believe in world peace. They have been very, very unsupportive. In fact, of our position, because they see what we're doing as yet again the West getting up in high moral dudgeon and imposing its will. And they're not going to be part of it. Robert referred quite correctly to Russia's exclusion from the G8, which is now the G7 again. What he didn't refer to, because it's not been in the Western press, is that there was a small move in the much more important G20 to exclude Russia. And that's where the economic action is these days, promptly squashed by the likes of China and India. The reality is that we in the West may isolate ourselves from Russia, but Russia ain't going to be isolated from the world as a result of our action. So don't do the impossible. And secondly, don't deepen the confrontation. A lot of words about sanctions here. Sanctions have been a disaster. They have not changed Russian policy one jot, and evidently won't. This is much more important to Putin than mere money. This is about Russian figura. He's not going to be moved by Western sanctions. There have been economic impacts, but the direct sanctions have not been material. And indeed, in Moscow these days, you can hear people complaining that they're not on the list. It's become a badge of patriotic pride to be on the sanctions list. Sanctions are always bad with regard to Russia. We have had six lots of Western economic sanctions against Russia, Soviet Union, since the Second World War. None of them have worked. Look at this lot. You're looking at France, still, for goodness sake, building a warship for Russia. There's very little prospect of these things being made effective. And to the extent that they are stepped up. They're simply going to help push Russia away from its links with the West towards links with China and other places. So those are the don'ts. What are the do's? Now, there are some obvious things which we are doing and are right to do. We need to reassure our allies, places like Poland, Latvia, Lithuania. I believe their fears are unfounded, but they have understandable fears about Russian behaviour, and we should help them through the alliance to meet those fears and begin to get the temperature down. But the most important thing we should be doing, and this is the moment where you all accuse me of being an appeaser, we should be looking for a deal. J.K. Galbraith once said, all politics is a choice between the unpalatable and the disastrous. If we maintain a confrontational approach to Russia, we are looking at disaster. We're looking at a constantly destabilised Ukraine, at a continuation of the civil war, at a deterioration of the situation in all sorts of other ways. We look for a deal which meets their concerns and meets ours and then enables everybody actually to live better. And the deal is there. It's on the table. The things the Russians want actually are also the things that Poroshenko is increasingly inclined to give. Autonomy for the Russian-speaking reasons. There it is. Poroshenko's already talking about it. Getting the fighting under control. Poroshenko's about to go for a ceasefire. And Poroshenko has not said a word about Ukraine moving towards NATO since he became president, because he knows very well that that would simply throw more oil on the flames. The deal's doable. So we should be looking for it. We should be encouraging Poroshenko. We should be supporting him. And that is better for Ukraine, because the choice is, the fact is that the Russians have immense capacity, as they're still showing, for destabilizing Ukraine, for making life uncomfortable for Ukrainians. The gas is about to be turned off, we gather. You have to do a deal with them in order to create the opportunity for Ukrainians to rebuild their truly appalling society and to move in a democratic and prosperous direction, which actually, as I said, Ukraine very close to Russia, would be a useful example for Russia itself. You can only do that with an undestabilised, if there's such a word, Ukraine. You can only do that with a Ukraine which is living with Russia, which is living with the West, and which is conducting its own fate. I would remind you, of course, of the examples of Finland and Austria during the Cold War, where exactly the same technique was adopted. They both emerged as very prosperous, very successful democracies. No reason why Ukraine shouldn't go the same way. My final point, however, is about Russia itself. It's quite slightly hard to remember in the midst of the current crisis, but Russia, behind everything, behind the growing authoritarianism, is a country which was gradually moving in the right direction. It's getting richer, bigger middle class, increasing hunger for Western-style governance, for Western-style liberties, increasing discomfort with the corruption and repression which the Putin regime carries with it. That progress most manifestly made clear in the 2011-2012 massive demonstrations in Moscow and elsewhere against their style of government. Didn't work. There's a counter-movement going on now, more authoritarianism. But that evolution is there. Go to any Russian provincial city and you find a place which looks more and more European, if I can put it that way. That progress, which ought in time to turn Russia into a decent neighbour, a comfortable neighbour, a friend and a helper in the international issues, and we need them. We need them to help us deal most currently with Islamic extremism in the Middle East. That progress has been stopped dead by the confrontation now about Ukraine. That confrontation has turned into a massive surge of nationalism in Russia, of support for the Putin regime, of contempt for a West which tries, Robert's word, to isolate Russia. We need to get out of this impasse. We need to find a way back to helping the good Russians, the Russians who are tomorrow's Russians, to turn Russia into a civilized democratic society. Thank you.